We come to the 11th presentation in the Hermetic Bodhisattva's year. And I would like to just take a moment to acknowledge the birthdays of two of the three founding trustees of the Shared Presence Foundation, Lord Northampton and my wife Nisa. And they're both born within a few days of each other, and just a day or so from Shakespeare. So great spirits are very much alike. I have a Libra sun, but I have a Aries moon, which is exactly in between their birthdays. So thank you. We're looking at the way in which a characteristic quality comes into play at the very end of the first century AD, starting about 90 AD, and coming then very quickly after 100 AD into a powerful form which had been for about 350 years, 400 years, the development of the ability for human beings to refine the dialogue, the speaking with each other, so that instead of arguing pro and con as a duality, they cooperated together to refine so that one could begin to find not just common ground, but to raise that common ground. And it was discovered that there are a finite, very small number of levels before the pro and con lose their duality and begin to assume not a commonality, but a complementarity, which resolves itself finally in being able to behold that there never was a reality to the duality. And that because there is only the Greek word aletheia, there's only truth, if one holds to discovering the truth by refining the commonality into complementarity, one can, as they say, become capable of discerning what is real. When dialogue was first mooted seriously as an art form was by a Greek named Aeschylus, who was born about 525 BC, and his first Greek tragedy was called the Persians, because they had just won two enormous battles against a superior Persian force. And Aeschylus, being by that time a middle-aged Greek noble, took part in the first defeat that the immense Persian army experienced, and that was at the Battle of Marathon. Marathon is a plain that extends about 5-6 miles out of a couple of mountain passes to the coastline of Greece, about one mountain range away from the area where ancient Athens was located. And by bringing ashore a massive armed force, they hoped to isolate the Athenians by just sweeping the countryside and taking over everything around it and then sending ships to be a lance in this surrounded thing and decimate them. But the classical Athenian Greeks had an ethos of courage beyond belief, and fully armed, they poured out of the closest mountain pass and ran full bore across the Marathon plain and stopped them before they were able to get all of their forces ashore. And eventually, it was like D-Day in World War II. The Persian command crumbled because they were shocked that anyone would do this. And among them was Aeschylus. And when he died at 90, though he was the creator of Greek tragedy, his tombstone read, "Here lies Aeschylus, who fought at Marathon, and the long-haired Persians still tell of it." His creation of the beginnings of Greek tragedy began to have an appeal to the high genius of classical Greece. And very quickly, Sophocles came along. And though Aeschylus's language is that of a soaring eagle able to pounce, Sophocles has the distributed, massive calm of being able to weave the refinement so there is not so much a titanic rise and fall, a discovery, a denouement, as the Greek phrase is, of discovering that the tragedy inevitably is not in terms of a social issue, not in terms of a political or a military issue, not in terms of an economic issue, but that the tragedy is that one assumes that your individuality is going to have its willful way and win out, whereas the assumption that you have an individual will that could win out over others is a tragic moment, because you have believed something which is delusional, based on an illusion. And so the classical Greek tragedy was the discovery that all of this is much ado about nothing, and it's tragic because you have taken lives, you've wasted your life, you've wasted everything by trying to outwill, out-ego, out-individualize others, especially poignant, because you have cooperated in setting up that duality. It also works in a different chirality as classic old comedy, like Aristophanes, where you discover not the tragedy, but the high comedy, that all of this really is much ado about nothing. The person who refined that was Plato, who took the tragic and the comic and tuned them so that they were not chiralities one way or the other, but that they would have an equanimity which would raise itself starting with the beginnings of a pro and con based upon your opinion. The Greek word for that opinion is doxa, out of which we get the English word doxology, what one believes. The doctrine that everyone similar has that belief, that conviction, this is who we are, this is what we believe. You are different. You are out, we are in. That quality of doxa, Plato, in his dialogues, brings a teacher like Socrates into play, who is not there to argue, but is there to question. To question anyone from any angle, pro or con, what is it that you really believe? What is at the basis of what you believe? And eventually, in the exchange with Socrates, whoever the other participants are in the dialogue, they begin to rise from just doxa to claiming that they have thought this through and they have an informed opinion. And because it's an informed opinion, they become more entrenched and able to then parade their specificity to their advantage. And Socrates accepts this and does the same thing that he did with the original doxa. He takes the informed opinion and brings it so that it refines even more, so that they begin to sense that they need to challenge Socrates like he's challenging them. And so they begin to leech their informed opinion with his techniques, which they're not very good at. But quickly, in the dialogues, they begin to understand that as they begin to question Socrates socratically, the dialogue changes from an argument of pro and con. It matures out of opinion, out of informed opinion, into a semblance of that maybe there is a context which was hidden and now is being discovered or discoverable, revealed or revealable. And in that, if that third kind of dialogue level is raised one more time, everyone in the dialogue simultaneously, spontaneously, is able to see the truth, which is in the form of an epiphany. The Greek term epiphany means a sudden awakening that it was never about that or this. It was never about raising that or this to a really powerful level. It was never about anything other than learning how to communicate in a dialogue in the way in which there is something real, which is beholdable, which is discoverable. When Plato died at age 80 in 347 BC, Alexander the Great was 9 years old. The time of about 350 BC, in terms of the time forms of civilization, is the time form for establishing a new reference wave. And the reference wave that was established was that the dialogue had matured to the level at which a student of Plato could become the tutor of Alexander the Great. And that student of Plato, tutor of Alexander the Great, was Aristotle. And Aristotle was able to expand the dialogue into the treatise, the way in which one could write so that the reading of the treatise would alert you to a rhetorical way, not just a dramatic, poetic way, but a rhetorical way by which you could learn not just to explain to yourself, but even deeper than prove to yourself, you could educate yourself. And so the education of Alexander the Great, from the prize student of Plato's Dialogues, became the reference wave for the next 350 years of development, and that development by 0 BC had raised the dialogue in complementarity to the prose treatise so that they were able to tune together and become a new high-level art form analytic. Not just an aesthetic, but an analytic at the same time. So that the aesthetic art form and the analytic science form were tuned. They became paired, and that tunability matured consciousness. So that one could start, if one were scientific, one could start with a theory and could mature it through the aesthetic of dialogue into a history that was the raising of the levels to the beholdable aletheia, so that the analytic would be able to discover the truth of what was originally understood in the theory through the beauty of the persons who understood the theory, working together to produce a historical level of exchange, so that the poetic and the rhetoric, the rhetorical and the aesthetic together would render the analytic capable of discerning what is true in terms of what is beautifully realized, and that would be real. Two different areas developed at the same time: the ability to pair the poetic and the prose rhetorical together. The one in the Far East was the discovery of the Mahayana, the Great Way. All of the early Mahayana sutras have two different forms of the same sutra. They have a poetical form, and then they repeat it in a rhetorical form. So you have a poetry by verse. In Sanskrit, the verse is called a shloka. A shloka is a pair of lines, that the first line carries the seed, the second line fertilizes the seed, so that the shloka with a pair of lines is able to pair with another shloka, so that you have four lines which are arranged in a pair of pairs, so that you get a square, a frame of reference in the written language, or if you read it out loud, in the declaimed language, so that one is able then to see by what classically is best understood in terms of world literature as the quatrain. And that these quatrains, because they have a continuity of their structure, are able to be paired yet again, and paired, and paired, and paired, and so that one gets the sense that a poetic is able to build a structure capable of an analytic in terms of a rhetoric, if read right, so that one takes the sense of hearing as the tunability of a poetic and a rhetoric together to produce a structure which is capable of a high analytic consciousness at the same time as being beautiful. All of the early Mahayana sutras are in this way. And the earliest one is the sutra translated is the Astasahasrika Sutra. And it's so early that the first translation out of Sanskrit into another language, which was China at that time, was 180 AD. So that the Astasahasrika Sutra, in its completeness of its poetical form and its prose form, were by the early 2nd century AD already in place. It became the way in which all sutras then began to be cast in this form. But the poetical part of the Astasahasrika Sutra was not a sutra, it was a gatha. It was a poetic song extended to 302 slokas so that they worked together like a daisy chain. Instead of being a frame of reference, the poetical form of the Astasahasrika, translated first into English in 1962, it was published. The Prajnaparamita Ratnaguna Samkhya Gatha. The translator here was Edward Kanze. The Astasahasrika, with both the poetry and prose, takes a kind of a Sophoclean balance. But when one comes to just the poetical form with the Prajnaparamita Ratnaguna Samkhya Gatha, one comes to the beautiful quality that's there in Plato, that you have the aesthetic prism of understanding that language, instead of being structured in an ongoing frame of reference, and you can appreciate this because an ongoing frame of reference is what early film was all about. So many frames per second. And if you have 32 frames per second, it's like a motion picture, with the emphasis that it's just a picture. It's just a movie. Film used to get stuck in the gate where it focused in the projector, and it would stutter, and you would be rudely interrupted that this is not, something's wrong with the projector. And psychologically, when one tries to live by frames of reference that are speeded up so that it has the appearance of something real, sooner or later, the gate will get dirty and you'll get the stutter. And that's where confusion begins to come into play. And it is not just neurotic, it becomes psychotic, because one doesn't clean the gate. One doesn't turn off the projector, which is even better, and see real instead of watching some movie. Only a mental state which is isolated and individually assumptive will have the problem of a dirty gate, a stuck frame of reference. They used to burn up you would see on the wide screen. The film would burst into flame. That's a breakdown. What's interesting about the early Gatha is that it was written about the same time that the Hermetica was written in Alexandria. And in the Hermetica, you have the art of the Platonic level of dialogue. After 350, 450 years, refined so that the Hermetica are what are able to be called high Dharma dialogues. They're not just dialogues so that one can discover what is true, the aletheia, but one can raise that, expand that, so that one is able to see what is eternally true. That high Dharma in the Mahayana and in the Hermetica was being attempted in the far west, in the ancient Britain, Celtic, Irish Sea area, Ireland, southern Scotland, what is now northern England, what is the Somerset and Cornwall area, linked to Brittany in France, what became France. The attempt there became sabotaged exactly about that time due to a catastrophic tragedy. So that one finds in the earliest qualities of the poetic extended into history, one finds that this tragic trigger makes a deep nostalgic loneliness. And one of the earliest collections of the aesthetic writing at that time is collected together as the Mabinogion. And in the Mabinogion, what is told is the tragedy that the carrier of the mitochondrial DNA of the Holy Family became seized after having three children. Her name was Penarden. And she was the daughter of Anna, who was the daughter of Susanna, who was the daughter of Mary, the mother of Jesus. So that Susanna was a sister to Jesus, and Anna was his only niece. All the other children of the other sisters were male. She was the only female, the only one that carried the mitochondrial DNA. So that her daughter, Penarden, was the only one that carried the mitochondrial DNA, and she had only one daughter. Her name was Branwen. And Branwen was mismarried to an Irish king who turned the story of Cinderella inside out. She started as a queen, and she ended up scrubbing pans in the kitchen, so that her older brother, Bran, went to rescue her and did. But so many people died, and so crushed was Branwen that she died of a broken heart, and that was the end of the mitochondrial DNA of the Holy Family. So that the ancient Irish, the ancient Welsh, the ancient West Country, Britain, the ancient Southern Scots have an enduring quality of the loneliness of an irreparable tragedy. Irreparable until there was discovered a way to raise that to a high Dharma level and open it up so that one could discern that this tragedy, irreparable in the social realm, in the personal realm, in the historical unbelievability, about 500 years later, a whole cycle of the Phoenix later, it was discovered that a new quality of community could be brought back together, because one could take the missing piece, the missing person, who would have been the carrier of the mitochondrial DNA, that one made a circle of males around a round table and left an open chair. In the Arthurian language, it's called the Siege Perilous. No man may sit in that Siege Perilous. It is to be left open. It is to be left open because the spirit that arrives to sit in that throne of the real is not phenomenal, is not even noumenal, but is high Dharma eternal. And so the quality always in the Arthurian is that all of the knights of the round table were descendants of the males of the Holy Family, who recognized that we have to leave a chair open at our round table. And it's interesting because about the same time, in Judaism, one of the symbols that came synchronistically, resonantly forth, was that on special holidays, Jewish festivals, a chair would be left unsat in, and it was called the Elijah chair. If you get a chance, you can look at the Encyclopedia Judaica under Elijah's chair, and there will be a photograph of such a chair. Highly, beautifully embroidered, decorated, not to be sat in, but to be kept present. Because the presence of the spirit would be able to inhabit that. In the High Mahayana, a illustration in a stupa designed by the great Buddhist architect Nagarjuna at a place on the Krishna River, very large river called Amaravati, you see an empty chair, and you see behind the empty chair a tree. This is the tree of life. This tree of life is able to have your name inscribed by a special spirit woman. And when your name is inscribed on the Persea tree, you are recorded in the Book of Eternity. And there is no way that that has any kind of a tragic denouement. It is not susceptible to a comic quality. It is real. That quality, which is poignant in the ancient West Celtic, which is philosophical in the Hermetic presentation, which is a fertile garden expanding in the Mahayana. Those three all have a quality of a harmonic which resurfaced in the 20th century. When we come back from the break, we're going to take a look at high Dharma science, which began to have a quality of maturity by 1927, which resulted in the fifth Salve conference in Belgium, in Brussels, named for an industrial wealthy man who sponsored the Salve conferences. And the fifth in 1927 was like a who's who of all the greats of mathematics and physics in the world at the time, who came together understanding that something immensely subtle had bubbled up to being ready to imbibe, that the food of a high Dharma truth was ready to be served. On the cover of this Cambridge University Press volume, Quantum Theory at the Crossroads of the 1927 Salve Conference, one finds Niels Bohr in one corner and Einstein in another. One finds Erwin Schrödinger in one corner, Heisenberg in another. But in the middle, what would be the middle? The lower one is Max Born, and the upper one is Louis de Broglie, actually the Duc de Broglie, one of the princes of France. And he's the one in the 1927 Salve conference who first posited what a pilot wave is. In the work here, that pilot wave, which has been refined several times during the 20th century, is raised in the early 21st century to a high Dharma presentation that can now be ready to be served. Let's take a break and we'll come back to that. Let's come back to our understanding of time forms of civilization. There are reference waves. There are carrier waves. There are pilot waves. The understanding of frequencies of energy was always discernible in a mystical way. And in certain analytics that made high poetic sense, but were not able to be real analytics until in the 20th century, beginning about 1927, when Prince de Broglie at the fifth Salve conference dominated the creative sense of the conference with his theory of pilot waves, which he derived from Einstein. In 1905, Einstein astonished the world with his first mooting of the theory of relativity, the specific theory of relativity, which then was refined to the general theory of relativity almost a generation later. It was someone of the caliber of de Broglie to be able to understand that the discovery by Einstein of the photon as the carrier of electromagnetic energy was a particle embedded in the wave carrier of electromagnetic energy, so that the photon as a particle was like the raisin in the cookie. That the wave is certainly the context, but that it carries an integral that is discernible in mathematics and in physics, the photon. De Broglie saw that this must be a universal characteristic, that all energy waves will have a particle that is embedded in it, and that it takes a very special expanded vision, an expanded theory, to be able to lift the horizon so that one sees that wave particles are pairs. They're tuned. And in the conference, it was apparent, because of the genius that was there, Heisenberg was able to discuss and say, this means then that there's no way to understand both of them together. We're always going to be uncertain. Not only because if we focus on the wave, we blur the particle. If we focus on the particle, we blur the wave. So we're always going to be uncertain, and the uncertainty principle came full blast. On the other side of the table, Schrödinger was genius enough to understand that there must then be a wave mechanics which is able to have within it some quality that rises above the uncertainty. And this spurred de Broglie to understand then that there must be a higher pilot wave that carries the hidden variables, which on a higher mathematic, the focus wasn't yet on dimensions, but soon would be, that on a higher mathematic, on a higher dimension, the hidden variables would be disclosable, but that it would take a refining of mathematics for who knows how long, but because it was imminent, the expectation was that by the next time we have a Solvay conference in a couple of 3 years, we'll be able to see how far we've gotten with this. But there was such a blast of criticality, because the wave mechanics of Schrödinger, the uncertainty of Heisenberg, the reluctance of someone like a Niels Bohr on his level, that the criticality began to work on de Broglie's pilot wave, and all through the quantum theory at the crossroads, just recently published by Cambridge University Press, in the retrospect, they said de Broglie's pilot wave theory was largely left in limbo, undiscussed, until 1952, a genius physicist, his name is David Bohm. David Bohm, American born, but American born in an early American way, refused to testify against his teacher in the House Un-American Activities run by Senator McCarthy, who was busy trying to discredit and did discredit Robert Oppenheimer, J. Robert Oppenheimer. Bohm had studied under Oppenheimer at University of California, Berkeley, and refused to testify and was about to be seized. So under Oppenheimer's suggestion, he left the United States permanently. He went all the way down to Sao Paulo in Brazil so that he could be outside of the reach of McCarthyism. He eventually would teach in Israel for a little while, but he found a true home in England. And it was while he was in England that he wrote a series of two articles in Physical Review, published in 1952, that had taken up the whole issue of de Broglie's famous pilot wave theory, and said, we are now entering into the 1950s, where we will be able to at last have the refinement to be able to understand the pilot waves carrying hidden variables, which will change the very nature of mathematics. And the 50s brought this forth. One of the great geniuses in that was Richard Feynman, who realized that however refined you make the mathematic, and you can, what's missing is the visionary presence of understanding that this is real, not just abstractions, whose math then is representational, that's based on equations that assume identification, and began to invent the Feynman diagrams. Something comes together, does something, and has an array that is left. And the refinement of Feynman diagrams was able finally to express in a new mathematical language something as complex as quantum electrodynamics, for which he and his two theorists, Sen Ituro and Julian Schwanger, received the Nobel Prize in physics. What's interesting about Bohm is that by this time, he had begun to sense that pilot waves carrying hidden variables are not just an intrinsic part, but that they're a calibration of the way in which the real discloses, not itself, but is disclosable, beholdable. And he began to find affinity with one of the great spiritual teachers of the 20th century, with Krishnamurti. And so Krishnamurti and David Bohm initiated having a series of dialogues which led him finally to have the courage to come back to the United States, back to a very much a post, very post-McCarthy United States. We're trying to find those who are trying to edge back to it again. But at that time, he began to offer a series of presentations in Ojai, California, not far here from Los Angeles, about 45-minute drive. And in that, the preface, just the first little couple of sentences, paragraph, "While Professor David Bohm is best known in academic circles as a theoretical physicist, he has long had interest in subjects considered outside the purview of traditional, quote, science. The nature of thought and consciousness, and how they affect both the individual and the society is one topic, and he says it is critical that we reach a better understanding of that question if we are to survive and lead meaningful lives." Let's pause there for a second. Let's come back to time forms for a second. The discovery that there is an aesthetic and an analytic, there is a vision and a history of civilization that was never fully expressible before. Only here at the beginning of the 21st century is it now expressible enough not just to make sense, but to develop its analytic beauty and its aesthetic accuracy, or vice versa. As we have been expressing, the metronome of time forms in civilization is in terms of a millennium, 1,000 years. So that reference waves will have a millennial pace, and carrier waves will have a millennial pace, and they'll be syncopated. The reference wave millennia will come about 350 years before the carrier wave is established. And when there is a millennial reference wave, there will be a millennial pivot in the middle of the larger structure of the carrier wave. So that what gets analytically revealed, not revealed mystically, but revealed analytically, so that one then can understand the shaping of history in civilization, such that one can understand the persons in their aesthetic prismatic beauty and creativity, but also there is the historical, which in its kaleidoscopic accuracy arrays allows for the analytic of science to refine itself so that there is such a thing as a science of civilization. There is such a thing as an art of civilization. And as an example, we were talking about how 350 BC with the end of Plato's life and work and the beginning of Alexander's life and work, mediated by Aristotle in both cases. If you move a millennium ahead from 350 BC, you come to 650 AD. So that there is a reference wave at 650 AD. And it doesn't take very much to be able to see the explosive realization that this is the beginning of the genius of Muhammad. So that the foundation of Islam is a millennial reference wave to Alexander the Great's founding of a world empire, and one sees that Islam conquers that empire of Alexander the Great and extends it all the way to where Alexander was hoping in his young life, he was just in his 30s, to expand to the West. And Islam extended itself not only from southern Spain all the way into India, but eventually all the way into Indonesia as well. But there's also a realization in there that very often there are pairs that operate in reference waves, and we'll see in carrier waves. The pair to Muhammad is the founding, the energizing of the Tang Dynasty in China. The genius of that was Tang Tai Tsung, really somebody. The whole realization that a reference wave at 650 AD, a millennium after Plato and Alexander the Great, one turns to ask, what was the millennium before the closeout of Plato and the beginning of Alexander the Great? And you go from 350 BC back to 1350 BC. And right away, it's apparent explosively. It's Moses. So that when you look at the full two millennium, 2,000 year pace of a reference wave, you see that Muhammad is not only a millennium after Alexander the Great, he's an aeon after Moses, so that they're related in time forms of civilization reference waves. It's very powerful. For the carrier wave coming 350 years later, if one goes from 0 BC, which is the proverbial abstract, you go back to 2000 BC, and there you find a pair again who archetypally tune the way in which carrier waves will then accumulate their energy, accumulate the energy of time, and extend the range of the dimensions of space. The pair at 2000 BC is Abraham and Zarathustra. So that carrier wave of 2000 BC comes back into play at the beginning of the next aeon, because the descendant after 42 generations from Abraham is the birth of Jesus, but the confirmation comes from the three magi who were also 2,000 years after Zarathustra. And because they came from Iran, in order to get to Bethlehem At the time of the birth, within a few days, they had to be able to see by a constellation analytic, by star field analytics and vision, that it was going to happen. It was going to be in this vicinity at this time. So they had to set out maybe 3 months in advance to be able to get to that locale at that time, so that they didn't come because of the event. There was no causality. They came to the event. They came on time. They came in situ, in place, but they also came prepared, bearing gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which are valuable even in small quantities, something that a man could either pack onto a mule, onto a black donkey, for instance, and be able to sustain life for some years. So they came prepared, understanding that there would have to be a flight. There would have to be a get out of town moment, get out of the country moment. So they came prepared, on time, in the right place. And it was the first triple seal that this event was real. That not only was it real, but it was real because it began like the cosmos began, with an emergence point, with that particularity of that point in space-time, but that that particle, that point in space-time, was in the context of an enormous energy wave, frequency that was able to create the cosmos. What's interesting, as we have been seeing, is that time emerges out of eternity spontaneously. And when it does, instantaneously, because now there is time, space blossoms out of it. So that it's almost impossible to be refined enough to see, to behold, to understand that time is the first dimension, but instantly space blossoms out of it. But blossoms out of it because not that it statically is or isn't, but that its isness is iterative, spaced by is-notness. So that whatever phenomenally occurs, or even noumenally, super occurs, the ones and zeros are evenly spaced. And in between each iteration of one, there is also an iteration of zeros. So one has to learn that it is illusory to only look at the ones and to think that it just is. It always carries is not with it, not as a burden, not as a duality, but as the expressive complementarity of the way in which the real, we can't even say is, but it never not is real. But it also never not is not real. And so the high Dharma, getting rid of all of the illusion so that delusion does not occur at all, not only does not occur at all, never could have occurred at all. So that all of the delusions are a bad nightmare that never happened. And all of the triumphs are interesting illusions that also never happened. That this is a very difficult way to be. And so the great Mahayana Prajna Paramita, perfection of wisdom, sutras say that it takes getting over the fearfulness of standing in emptiness and to realize that you can't stand in emptiness and yet you do. That there is such a thing then as some kind of a periodicity. The periodicity of the iteration of energy, first of all, the waveform that is time, it's an energy. It has a periodicity, and its periodicity is by the frequency of the crests and troughs of the sine wave recording of the way in which we see. This is the frequency. But the carrier of that frequency is not the troughs, it's not the crests, it's the zero horizon that doesn't occur, that keeps the symmetry symmetrical. Not equal in terms of identity, but symmetrical in terms of dynamic. So that time is a dynamic. And one of the earliest carriers of that dynamic is that when it moves dynamically, it generates heat. So that one of the earliest really solid analytics was thermodynamics. But before it carries heat, it carries something that is more subtle than heat and occurs spontaneously before space blossoms instantly, and that is sound. The sound has a primordial emergence dynamic so that its iteration is not only a primordial sound, but is also symmetrically a primordial silence. And without the primordiality of silence, one would never be able to have a sound so that you could hear someone speak like I'm speaking. You can hear the syllables of the words distinctly because they are actually on very high Dharma level interspersed with silence. And one can refine oneself to, quote, hear the silence so that the speaking and the sound, the language in our case, is intelligible because one carries a quality of zeros in between, which at the very same parity are able to carry infinity as well. The Hermetic and the Mahayana, and eventually the wisdom of the far west, understood that we're able to refine ourselves to be real. And when we do, we get something like this. This is my translation of just two little six-line sections of Zarathustra's Gathas. at 2000 BC, which resurface as the quality of the poetic in the Prajnaparamita Ratnaguna Samkhya Gatha. I to you in Asha, weaving, wreathing, hymns in Vohuman as circlets, to Mazda and to Ahura, through my Kshatra boundlessly, ever resonant in Armeti, in my joy my calling comes. My deep self, exalted abode, the good equanimous mind, with Asha in deeds of knowing Mazda Ahura, until will and strength encompass, I educate by striving for Asha. This learning at 2000 BC, resurfacing as the three magi at 0 BC, re-emerges refined again at 2000 AD in such a thing as someone being able to translate Zarathustra's Gathas from 4,000 years ago with an aesthetic, analytic clarity, which is double Aeonic in its spread, which means that the pivot then of that larger time form of civilization, that pivot is 0 BC. But when one looks at the lineage of the time forms of civilization, you can go back 2,000 years before 2000 BC, which is 4,000 BC, which is the date of Adam and Eve. But when you do so, the symmetricality of the energy goes forward 2,000 years to 4,000 AD. And one can see that this great equanimity shows that what ended quite recently began instantly then and extends for the next 2,000 years, which will have its punctuations millennially in terms of 500-year cycles, in terms of new reference waves, leading up to a carrier wave that has a peculiar quality of language to it. Because the reference wave before 4000 BC was the discovery that one could have a discursive written language, not just signs and tokens, better to call them tokens even, because that's what they were. The archaeologists used to throw away the little ceramic clay, baked clay. They look like Monopoly players. And they didn't realize that this was the way that they counted transactions of business, of trading. And they kept them in little clay envelopes that were about the size of the palm of a hand, so that when you cemented the deal, you sealed that envelope, and that gave you the right to have these things because you have these tokens. Then they discovered that you could write on the handheld piece of clay what was in it. And that was the beginning of a token numeracy of language. And it took several thousand years to be able to have a literate written language. The carrier wave that came 2,000 years later, that manifested itself as a carrier wave 350 years later as the carrier wave, was that one was able to have an alphabetic language. In 0 BC, the refinement was that one was able to read between the lines so that you had multiple meanings, like allegory. And in our time, you had the digitization of language. So one can look forward to 4000 AD, when the wreathing crown of language is that one can read infinitely in the digital iteration of any analytic or any aesthetic without time limits. More next week.